Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by DUPECO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken in his regular Friday reader seat. I'm down in the hotter-than-Dubuque Ozarks right now visiting family, but we'll get right to today's front page article. And the top one is Reynolds signs workforce bill, and it's headed up first by a rather large picture of Governor Reynolds signing in the bill, and the caption beneath it reads, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signs bills into law Thursday during the Iowa Association of Business and Industry Conference at Grand River Center in Dubuque. And she is surrounded by half a dozen people, hands applauding as she sits in a red jacket and black top, signing the bill. And our article reads, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday signed three bills into law that she said will help address the state's workforce woes during Iowa Association of Business and Industry's annual conference in Dubuque. Reynolds told a crowd of hundreds of business professionals and government officials that the new laws passed by the Iowa legislature this year will remove what she sees as barriers to Iowa's re-entering the workforce. She called them examples of bold policy that have made room for growth and prosperity during her time in office. If you put all of this together, I think it's clear there's never been a better time to believe in Iowa and the businesses that create our economy, she said. Our goal is to complement and empower the essential work you do every day. One law, signed by Reynolds, cuts the amount of time people can collect unemployment benefits after losing a job from more than 6 months down to 4 months, and prohibits them from turning down a job offer while collecting unemployment. We're working with unemployed people, but it's definitely something that will move us in the right direction, Reynolds said. To supplement the cut, Iowa Workforce Development has started offering one-on-one career counseling for people seeking to enter the workforce. We want to reach individuals who want to either upscale or have stepped out for a while to encourage them to get back into the workforce, Reynolds told the Telegraph Herald after her remarks at the Taking Care of Business conference. Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend attended the event and said her staff call people the week they file for unemployment to set up appointments for a resume review and interview training and to connect them with employers, matching their qualifications. The whole point is to reduce the amount of time you're between jobs, she said. During a campaign stop in Dubuque earlier this week, Democratic challenger for governor, Deidre DeGeer, said cutting unemployment will not bring people back to the workforce and will only harm them further. She said the real answer to Iowa's workforce crisis is in higher wages. Every state around the state of Iowa seems to be paying higher wages than Iowa, she said, promoting a minimum wage increase as one step. I don't want our river towns to be bedroom communities where people work on the other side of the river and live over here. Another law Reynolds signed Thursday increases the number of children who can be cared for by a child care center worker to 7 children 2 years old and younger and 10 children 3 or 4 years old. It also lowers the minimum age at which child care workers can care for children without adult supervision to 16. After her speech, Reynolds touted these changes as options and not requirements for providers. If they think that will allow them to bring additional children into their care, they can do that, she said. Deb McConnell, a director for Youngins Preschool and Child Care Center in Dubuque, was skeptical of both law changes. I understand where the governor is coming from with these, she said in a phone interview after Reynolds signed the bill into law. I understand there is a great need for spaces, but at what cost? When we're trying to enhance programs and the quality of programs, I think this diminishes that. It's going to cause some more burnout for staff, and I don't necessarily think that 16-year-olds are mature enough and have the background, education, experience to work with 7 2-year-olds, or even 6 2-year-olds for that matter. Other area child care providers spoke favorably of bills with these changes when they were being considered during the legislative session, noting the flexibility they could offer providers. The third law Reynolds signed expands work-based learning programs for high school students, creates healthcare workforce recruitment programs, and restricts city and county government inspections of manufactured homes. Iowa Association of Business and Industry Chairman Jack Haskin, who is also president and CEO of Jackson Manufacturing, Inc. in Maquoketa, thanked Reynolds for her service while introducing her, touting her invitation from Republican U.S. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to deliver her party's response to Democratic President Joe Biden's State of the Union address this year. Her remarks were spot on for what was happening in Iowa and across the United States, he said. The Iowa Association of Business and Industry is officially a nonpartisan organization. In recent elections, the group's Political Action Committee, Iowa Industry PAC, has made nearly all of its donations to Republican campaigns. The PAC's board met Thursday with Reynolds before her address to the full conference, Association Mike Ralston said when he introduced Reynolds. The PAC did not donate to Reynolds' campaign, though, in 2018, and has not so far for the 2022 election cycle. Our second piece from above the fold, Cincinnua Dominicans downsizing at Mound, from Cincinnua, Wisconsin. For almost 180 years, the Dominican Sisters of Cincinnua Mound have cared for the land, their neighbors, and one another. But with the dwindling number of sisters over the decades, the 450-acre Cincinnua Mound campus, which includes 425,000 square feet of building space, is undergoing some radical changes to ensure its future. The congregation, headquartered in rural Grant County, Wisconsin, is working with a real estate company to sell some of the buildings on its campus in hopes of finding a buyer that aligns with its mission. We've realized for a long time that we have more buildings than we have a need for, Prioress Sister Tony Harris said. Harris said cultural changes have led to declining numbers of novitiates entering religious orders. We were close to 2,000 sisters in the mid-60s, she said. We are now 295. The Second Vatican Council stated very clearly that everybody was called to holiness, every baptized person, and that no particular lifestyle has a corner on holiness. Harris said this led to a paradigm shift within the Catholic Church. For many of us, prior to that, religious life was viewed as the best way to be a holy person and to serve God, she said. The council kind of disrupted that thinking, and in the culture at large, there were a lot more options for women emerging. For the past 5 years, the congregation has been in planning mode, focusing its efforts on finding a partner who would be interested in taking over the campus's three-story rotunda building, a 95,640 square foot space that includes the Queen of Rosary Chapel and a 500-seat auditorium, among other amenities. We didn't get anybody to step forward, Harris said. So the decision to actually list the buildings we don't need for sale was made in January of this year. In addition to the Rotunda Building, the St. Clara Convent and the Siena Complex are also on the market. The St. Clara Convent, which includes both residential and multi-purpose space, is 59,400 square feet. The Siena Complex includes an industrial kitchen, Cincinnua Bakery, a dining hall, a pool, living and community spaces, offices and meeting space. The building totals 162,700 square feet. The buildings are listed with Milwaukee-based Cushman and Wakefield Berkey, a real estate company that specializes in office, industrial, and retail markets. We chose them because of their specialization in these kinds of spaces, Harris said. In February 2020, the congregation contracted with Marquardt Management, a Watertown, Wisconsin-based management company, to assist with long-term planning. Marquardt's employee, Stephanie Burris, has been the campus administrator at Cincinnua since March of this year. My goal is to assist the sisters through this transition and help with the day-to-day operations, she said. Transparency has been key in the decision-making process, Harris said, particularly where the more than 100 employees of Cincinnua Mound are concerned. We've tried to be as transparent as we can and say, we know this is going to impact dining. We know this is going to impact healthcare, she said. We're hoping that we can help mitigate that impact by assisting those employees in finding other positions or employing them elsewhere here. While the Academy Apartments, an older adult apartment building, which serves those over 55, both from the congregation and from the wider community, will not be impacted by the changes. Sisters who live in the assisted living portion of the campus will be. Those sisters will move to Staircrest in Muskego, Wisconsin, Harris said. The new assisted living facility currently is being constructed and will be ready for residents from Cincinnua in the spring of 2023. St. Dominic Villa, which provides skilled care to community residents and sisters, will continue to operate with Marquardt Management and Southwest Health, which has owned the facility since July 2020, at the helm. Cushman and Wakefield Berkey will present interested potential buyers to the sisters in August. Should there be no interested parties or none that meet with the sisters' approval, the buildings will be deconstructed. I certainly hope, and I think everybody hopes, that there's a partner that will come in and buy these buildings and that they and the sisters can work hand in hand, Burris said. I know that's the goal. While there will be a continued Dominican presence on the campus with community programs and services continuing, Harris said she hopes there is a new partnership on the horizon to operate the buildings being sold. We want a group that's mission aligned, of course, she said. That's a pretty broad stroke. I think that a group responding to human needs, a group that might meet the needs of women and children, whether it's a shelter for victims of domestic abuse, educational programs, job preparation, it would be perfect for that. Now our third and final front page piece, one we don't hear about often. ACT of Perfection, Dubuque Student ACES Exam. After earning a 33 on her first attempt at the ACT last summer, Cora Harvey was pleased with her score. But when the incoming Hempstead High School senior learned about Dubuque Community Schools' Pave the Way Testing Day event, which allows all juniors in the district to take a free post-secondary exam, she decided to give the ACT another go in March. I just figured I would take it again while it was free to see if I could get even a point higher, said Cora. the daughter of Mike and Melissa Harvey. Cora bettered her results by more than 1 point. She received a perfect 36, the highest possible score on the ACT. As part of the exam that is used by many colleges to make admissions decisions, students take tests in English, mathematics, reading, and science. Each section is scored on a scale of 1 to 36, and students receive a composite score from the average of those four scores, with an optional ACT writing test reported separately. In the United States high school graduating class of 2021, just 4,055 out of nearly 1.3 million students who took the test received a 36, equating to about one-third of 1%, according to the ACT's annual profile report. Cora was honored for her achievement at this week's meeting of the Dubuque Community School Board. Superintendent Stan Reingans said her score marked only the third time in his 10 years as superintendent that a student in the district had earned a perfect 36. For someone to come through the system and get a perfect ACT is just fantastic. And it says a lot about you and your study habits and your work ethic, Reingans told Cora. He also announced that the district would be presenting Cora with a laptop in honor of her achievement. To prepare for the exam, Cora used ACT practice tests and took advantage of test preparation materials that her teachers provided. Because she and her peers had taken the test on the same day at the Pave the Way event, they all received their scores at the same time in mid-April, and the hallway was abuzz with the chatter that day at school. I checked my score, and I didn't really even know what to say, Cora said. The soft-spoken student sent a simple text to her mother and told only a few friends the exciting news. Hempstead Principal Lee Colker described Cora as a humble and grounded student who is self-motivated to explore any area of study that interests her. I think this score speaks well of her education and shows that all the teachers that she's had from kindergarten to this point have helped inspire her in terms of learning new things and how to keep improving, he said. Despite garnering the top score, Cora did tease her mother that she might want to retake the test because she didn't have time to finish two questions on the math portion of the exam. She's always just had a natural curiosity, and she just loves to learn and take in information, Melissa Harvey said. For her, those two problems were probably just burning in the back of her brain. Cora advised students preparing for the ACT to use practice tests or take the test multiple times to become familiar with the format and time limits for each section. I'm someone that likes to recheck my answers and go back and make sure I'm right, and you don't necessarily have time for that on the ACT. So time management was the most difficult part for me, she said. Cora plans to major in genetics or a related field such as microbiology in college and to pursue a research-focused career. Her perfect ACT score has opened additional doors in her college search. Since my 36, my plans have kind of changed slightly, Cora said. At first, I was pretty set on going to Iowa State University, which is still definitely a contender. But I'm also now looking at schools like Yale and Princeton. Whatever school Cora chooses, Colker said her academic prowess, strong character, and leadership skills will set her up for success. I think that kind of a score is part of what's going to help make her successful. And whatever she chooses to do after Hempstead High School, she's got all the other pieces as well, he said. I think that's what's really going to help her stand out as she moves forward. Now we'll look at news from Dubuque and the tri-states. Play pickleball updates sought for Dickeyville Park. From Dickeyville, a new splash pad and updated playground equipment are among the major changes coming to Dickeyville Park in the next few years. Community leaders currently are working to raise $250,000 for multiple stages of park improvements, with a celebration planned for later this month to mark the end of the first phase of work. One of the things that has lacked in Dickeyville is our parks, and this is a chance for our parks to grow with our community, Dickeyville Mayor Matt Gattenbein said. It'll bring everyone together for everyone to have fun. The project will be completed in phases over the next several years, said Cheryl Keeler, a member of the committee overseeing the project. While exact project costs have not been finalized, community members are in the process of starting a foundation to apply for grants for the work as they continue to raise funds. Phase one includes converting the park's tennis courts into one full-size basketball court and four pickleball courts. Those improvements are on track to finish up by July 1, and a community celebration is scheduled for 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. on June 29 in the park. A splash pad will be added in phase two. A $50,000 matching donation already has been received, and the goal is to have the amenity open next summer, depending on fundraising efforts. Gattenbein said he thinks community members are most excited for this second phase, as there aren't any other splash pads in the nearby area. If we could draw people from the neighboring towns with the splash pad, it'd be great to get more interaction in the community and for our local businesses, he said. Workers then will update and replace playground equipment in phase three in 2024. The current set is older and made of wood. There's lots of wood. There's lots of splinters, Keeler said. So we're going to replace that with new equipment. A second baseball field also could be added in the third phase, Keeler said, though that project could get pushed further down the line depending on funding. The improvements come with no tax increases for area residents, as the project will be funded by donations and any grants the Dickeyville Park Foundation receives. Gattenbein said excitement about the updates is high in the community, especially in terms of how it could help draw younger families to the area. We're in the process of growing our town, he said. By adding amenities, we're hoping we'll bring in some younger families too and continue to grow with everyone. One more piece from the Dubuque area. Dubuque eyes grant to purchase first electric buses. City of Dubuque officials seek funding for a $4.1 million project to add their first electric buses to their transit fleet. The project would include purchasing three electric buses and two charging stations and installing solar panels on the roof of the Jewel Operation and Training Center to power the vehicles. Dubuque City Council members recently unanimously approved applying for a $3.4 million grant from the Federal Transit Administration's Low or No Emission Vehicle Program. The city would pay the remaining $759,260 required to fund the project. Ryan Nuke, the city's Director of Transportation Services, said the 35-foot electric buses would replace three existing gas-powered buses in the city's 32-bus fleet. The new buses would mark the first major purchase in the city's long-term goal to transition its transit fleet to electric vehicles. These are obviously very expensive purchases, so we are trying to get grant funding to offset that, Nucky said. It will greatly reduce our carbon footprint. The move to transition the city's vehicles from gas to electric-powered was one of the major goals outlined in the city's Community Climate Action and Resiliency Plan, which aims to reduce the city's overall greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2030 compared to 2003 emission levels. The most recent greenhouse gas inventory conducted by the city in 2018 stated that 20% of the community's emissions, about 167,132 metric tons of carbon dioxide, come from transportation vehicles. The city's climate action plan estimates that a full transition of the city fleet to electric vehicles could reduce emissions by 3,616 metric tons of carbon dioxide. "It's one of our main strategies in our climate action plan," said Gina Bell, sustainability coordinator for the city. "If that transition were to happen, it would create a significant reduction. However, it might still be some time before the first electric buses take to Dubuque streets." Nucky said city officials won't be notified if they will receive the grant until this fall, and worldwide high demand for electric buses means that it could take an additional 12 months before the city receives the vehicles. All the bus manufacturers are all 12 to 15 months behind already, Nucky said. Everyone is trying to buy them right now. Nucky said city staff members have spoken with several surrounding cities that already have added electric buses to their city fleets, including Moline, Illinois, Iowa City, and Des Moines. Those communities indicated they have had a positive experience with the transition. "We are seeing a lot of excitement for what these cities have," Nucky said. "The technology is only getting better." You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap, brought to you in part by DUPACO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. We are reading from the Friday, June 17th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, and it's Ken at the center of the reading. We now turn to today's obituaries. Sarah B. Wallace, Groshiat, Wisconsin. Sarah Betty Wallace, 41, of Groshiat, Wisconsin. "Our angel here on earth got her wings and went to heaven on June 14th. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Sunday, June 19th at Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, Wisconsin. A private family burial will be held at a later date. Family and friends may call on Sunday, June 19th from 11 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. The Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, Wisconsin is serving the family. Sarah was born in Beloit, Wisconsin to Jim and Candy Wallace, December 4th, 1980. She lived there until 1990 when the family moved to Richland Center. In 2000, the family moved again to Groshiat, and she lived there the rest of her life. She attended school in all three areas, participating however she could, making friends, and touching many lives along the way. She graduated from Black Hawk High School and then attended Howden Center in Mineral Point through her adult life. Sarah enjoyed music and spending time with family and friends. She was known for her unique magnetism, pleasant demeanor, and she touched the lives of all who she met. Sarah had many challenges that she faced in her life, but she always met them with her own unique, quiet strength. She enriched our lives daily, teaching us and constantly reminding us of the really important things in life. Her beauty radiated from the inside, and many were drawn to it and her sweet nature. Her resilience in life was admired by all who knew her, and she inspired us all to be better people. She will be sadly missed by all who knew and loved her, but her life story will continue to inspire us forever. She is survived by her parents and other family members. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Sarah B. Wallace Memorial Fund has been established. Memorials may be mailed to Howden Shield Funeral Home, care of Sarah Wallace Family, P.O. Box 825, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.howdenshieldfuneralhome.com. Joanne M. Ray, Tiffin, Iowa. Joanne Marie Finn Ray, 83, died Tuesday, June 14th at her home in Tiffin. She was surrounded by family. A visitation for Joanne will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, June 17th at the Rife Funeral Home in Cascade, where a wake service will be held at 3:30 p.m. Visitation will also be held after 11 a.m. Saturday, June 18th at the funeral home. A massive Christian burial will be held for Joanne at 12:30 p.m. on Saturday, June 18th at St. Peter's Catholic Church, 20121 Temple Hill Road, Cascade. Graveside service will follow in St. Peter's Cemetery. Joanne Marie Finn was born March 13th, 1939, to Louis and Josephine Finn in Temple Hill. She graduated from high school at the Immaculate Conception Academy in Dubuque. Years later, in her 30s, she completed her associate's degree in nursing from Kirkwood Community College and became a registered nurse. Joanne served in that role for about 25 years at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. She also worked for 3 years as a nurse at the Iowa Men's Reformatory in Anamosa. She was united in marriage to Jerry Ray on May 1, 1976 in Anamosa. Upon retirement, Joanne continued to work as a visiting nurse for children. Joanne was a giving soul to many people. She loved spending time with her 8 children and 24 grandchildren. She loved raising a garden as well as taking care of animals, especially her cats, Susie and Missy. She also loved traveling, spending time with her husband of 46 years, Jerry. Online condolences may be left online at www.rifefuneralhomeinc.com. Owen Diedrich, Cedar Rapids. Owen Arthur Diedrich, 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, June 11th. Memorial services will be held at a later date. Additional information at www.stuartbaxter.com. K. E. Nospi, Elkader. K. E. Nospi, 83, of Elkader, died Tuesday, June 15th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, June 20th, and from 9 to 10 a.m. Tuesday, June 21st, at Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Elkader, where services will follow. Interment will take place in East Side Cemetery in Elkader. Roger A. Huber. Roger A. Huber, 91, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, June 14th. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday at the Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 Kennedy Road. Massive Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Monday at the Church of the Nativity. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery, where military rites will be accorded. Roger was born February 23, 1931, in Dubuque, son of Joseph and Mildred Meschernecht Huber. He attended Dubuque Senior High School. Roger served in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. On May 12, 1956, he married Harriet Nakaval at Nativity Church. She preceded him in death on July 18, 2000. Roger worked at Interstate Power, now Alliant Energy, for many years, first as a meter reader, then in customer service. He retired in 1994. He was a longtime member of Nativity Church. Roger liked to stay active. He was a member of Lacoma Golf Course and could always be found playing Lacoma Red. He walked the course 4 times a week in the summer and played into his 80s. He loved to stay in his routines and was known as a creature of habit. He was a Bears and Cubs fan. He loved dogs and particularly his dachshunds, Mindy and Maggie Sue. To leave an online condolence for the family, please visit www.eaglehoffsiegertcasper.com. A Roger Huber Memorial Fund has been established. Linda L. Locke, Monticello. Linda Locke, age 81, died Sunday, June 5th at her home surrounded by her family following an illness of several months. A service of remembrance will be held 10:30 Tuesday morning, June 21st at the St. Matthew Lutheran Church, Monticello, with interment in the Oakwood Cemetery. Pastor David Ramish will officiate at the services. Visitation will be held on Monday, June 20th from 4 until 7 at the Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. By visiting GetchOnline.com, you may share your thoughts, memories, and condolences with Linda's family and sign the online guest book. Linda Lou Mest was born June 20th, 1940, at Dubuque, Iowa. She was the daughter of Marvin and Leela Morris Mest. Linda graduated from Dubuque Senior High School in 1958 and continued her education at the University of Iowa. She returned to Dubuque and worked at Interstate Power Company. Linda married Daniel Locke on August 5th, 1961, at St. Peter's Lutheran Church, Dubuque. The couple lived in Cuba City, Wisconsin, and Goose Lake, Iowa, where Dan taught school. In 1970, the couple moved to Monticello. Linda was employed at the Sears catalog store and later at German Mutual Insurance for 23 years. The couple had a summer home at Apple Canyon near Galena, Illinois for many years. Linda had been a campfire leader for 13 years, a rainbow girl, a member of Beta Club and the Tri Delta sorority at the University of Iowa. Her passion was her family, especially her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Margaret M. Schroeder, Bellevue. Margaret Schroeder, 87, of Bellevue, died Thursday, June 16th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Monday, June 20th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Bellevue, where services will follow. Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Bellevue is assisting the family. As with the sadness of our passings, we have the rejoicing of our new arrivals, and we have a whole bunch of them for today's. First ones, Tuesday, June 14th, Johnson, Brandon and Carolyn Johnson of Dubuque, a boy at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital, Dubuque. Hines, Burns, Andre Hines and Isabella Burns of Dyersville, a boy at Finley. Wednesday, June 15th, Shillman, Wyatt and Holly Shillman of Rickardsville, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Thole, Luke and Samantha Thole, or Tholey, of Cascade, a boy at Mercy One. Capacious, Jacob and Megan Capacious of Lamont, a boy at Mercy One. Myers, Kevin and Jenna Myers of Farley, a girl at Mercy One. And on Thursday, June 16th, Lucas, Joseph and Molly Lucas of Holy Cross, a girl at Mercy One. Welcome aboard, all you little angels, and we hope that life for you will be fulfilling. Now we turn to our opinion page and our view, the quick takes, the our view of our Dubuque Telegraph Herald editorial board. It represents their views. And today we have three smiley face ones. We start with the first one. Reingans, Coal Pits served community school districts well. The two biggest school districts in the TH coverage each are saying goodbye to a longtime leader. Dubuque Community Schools Superintendent Stan Reingans departs the district at the end of this month after 10 years in the top seat to become Chief Administrator of Keystone Area Education Agency. Reingans joined the district in 2004 as Executive Director of Human Resources before being appointed as Superintendent in 2012. His superintendency saw a decade of building renovations, technological innovations, curriculum discussions, and pandemic precautions. Meanwhile, Rick Colpitz is retiring from his role as superintendent of Western Dubuque Community School District, a position he's held for 7 years. Colpitz spent the 10 previous years in the Dubuque Community School District working as assistant principal and principal at Dubuque Senior High School before serving as the district's director of human resources from 2012 to 2015. A superintendent's work covers a vast array of duties, and in Colpitz's case, more than 550 square miles. For both leaders, the challenges and headaches of the role have been myriad as they sought to provide the best public education possible while managing public dollars. Both Reingans and Colpitz worked hard to meet the needs of their stakeholders, the students, the families, the teachers and staff, and the taxpayers. A salute to these superintendents for their efforts and best wishes for their future endeavors. Our second smiley face. While seeing the vast empty space where the FlexSteel Industries plant once stood in Dubuque's North End still brings a pang of disappointment, there's something of a silver lining in a segment of that area potentially going to a good cause. East Central Intergovernmental Association is working on getting a 16-acre parcel of land donated by FlexSteel to create heritage trail access to a wetland area. The parcel is along the trail adjacent to the former site of the FlexSteel plant at East 32nd and Jackson Streets. The access would provide a way for bikers, hikers, birders, and walkers to experience the unique ecology of the wetland area. While concerns of potential contamination at the site of the former furniture manufacturer linger, here's hoping any issues can be addressed and the wetlands path can be completed. And our third smiley face? If there's a dad you want to celebrate with this Father's Day, and he happens to like craft beer, there's plenty of toasting to be done right here in the tri-state area. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has declared June as Craft Beer Month in the state. The proclamation states that Iowa has more than 110 breweries, a total that has doubled since 2014. Not too hard to believe. A decade ago, the tri-state area had just a couple of local breweries. 10 years later, there are more than 20 breweries and tap rooms beckoning beer lovers to do a tri-state taste. While it might not be good for the bellies, the gathering spots have provided a boost to local economies and a broadening of the palate for local beer connoisseurs. Cheers to Craft Beer Month. Let's celebrate with a local pint. Today we have a number of letters to the editor, and we'll take our first one. Vote out those who value guns over kids. Dave Loney, Daniels Street, Dubuque. Enough already with mass shootings around the country. Our kids are not safe going to school. This doesn't happen in other countries. Not even close. Why do we put up with this? Nothing happens because of those in Congress beholden to the NRA. To them, guns are more important than our kids. That's obvious. Spare me your thoughts and prayers. 90% of us want expansion of background checks. 2/3 of us want assault guns banned. The only solution is to vote out of office those who are out of touch with the vast majority of Americans on this issue. Our next letter? Abortion isn't murder and shouldn't be illegal. Craig Reber, White Street, Dubuque. Against abortion? Simple. Don't have one. But don't prohibit another woman from having one. That's her choice. Surprise, it isn't murder. It's a surgical procedure, like having an appendix or ingrown toenail removed. Next one. Politicians should do more to keep citizens safe. Mike Widmeyer, Pennsylvania Avenue, Dubuque. As the massacres of our children, folks, grocery shopping, and churchgoers continues, I continue to ask myself, how can one party, Republicans, tell women you can't have abortions because it's murder, but on the other hand, have actually said that there is no reason to take automatic weapons off our streets? As a matter of fact, the majority of them want more guns in the hands of the good people to help fight crime. In English, this means we will tell women what they can and can't do with their bodies, and we will allow weapons on our streets that were designed to kill people in war. Mitch McConnell and his buddies have the blood of our children on their hands, and we all know that they will do absolutely nothing to offend the NRA unless they want their money cut off. It's too late to change the Neanderthal thinking of the money-grabbing politicians. So ask the question of them, what's more important, our children or automatic weapons? Our public safety or automatic weapons? They will look you in the eye and go with the company line. Isn't inflation just the worst thing? Kevin McCarthy says it's President Biden's fault. Enough already. You were elected to keep us safe. Do your jobs. Next, Iowa's representatives should vote for gun restrictions. Walter Pregler, Shiras Avenue, Dubuque. Those members of Congress who are resisting stringent rules on rapid-fire guns like the AK-47 should look at history. The Native American tribes successfully thrived on hunting with a spear or a bow and arrow. I am not aware of any rapid-fire spears or bow and arrows. They depended upon skill. So I ask Senators Grassley and Ernst, plus Congresswoman Hinson and Meeks, to vote for the strong rules in restricting rapid-fire weapons developed for military use by non-military citizens. Also, I hope they push for deep background checks for those who apply for carry permits. It wouldn't hurt to divorce yourselves from the NRA, too. City Council finally hears citizens' message on Five Flags proposal. Rick Trausch, Bradley Street, Dubuque. The City Council finally got the message from the taxpayers, no new Five Flags Center. It only took 4 years and over $100,000 in wasted consultant fees. Now they are looking at different scenarios, A, B, C, and D. If put to the taxpayer, none of these are going to fly. I dare them to poll their wards and see what the people say. All they have to do is buy an ice machine, fix the air conditioning, and add on to the bathrooms. Easy fix, and time to move on. Next, voter apathy deserves more attention. John McAndrew, Bluff Street, Dubuque. Just 16%, only 16% of voters voted in the June 7th primary in Dubuque. I learned this in a paragraph in an article about who won. Voter apathy is no longer even an occasion for its own article or headline. It's simply taken as the way things are, a matter of course. And yet people complain about their choice of candidates, corruption in government, and how government never does what the people want. Some surveys say 92% of Americans want universal background checks. A tiny number of people prevent that from happening. And still, we won't show up once or twice a year to vote. And our media shrug, as they presumably would if turnout fell below 10%. What do we expect to happen when the people in a democratic republic abdicate en masse? Next, don't tamper with Second Amendment. David Miller, North Water Street, Platteville, Wisconsin. The murder of 21 individuals, mostly children, in Uvalde, Texas, is indeed tragic. It was the work of a severely mentally deranged individual, not by a legitimate gun owner whose rights are guaranteed by the Second Amendment. Few criminals convicted of firearm offenses obtained their guns from licensed dealers. Changing the law from 18 to 21 will have little effect on the 40 million AR-15s in circulation. At 18, a man may be asked to give his life for his country and is considered an adult. Wisconsin has no minimum age for hunting, and a 14-year-old may hunt by himself with any legal long gun or at 18 with a pistol. Any gun or knife used in an assault automatically becomes an assault weapon. We hear outcries for more gun control. Last year, 43,000 people were killed in automobile accidents. No outcries to outlaw automobiles. Waukesha saw 6 people killed and over 50 injured by an SUV. No outcries to outlaw SUVs. About half of the automobile fatalities are the result of alcohol. The 18th Amendment outlawed beverage alcohol. It took 13 years and thousands of deaths to realize the mistake of tampering with the United States Constitution. Remember, it takes 3/4 of the states to ratify an amendment. Repealing the Second Amendment will never happen. Local church making alternate plans after theft damages air conditioner. This is another piece from our tri-states. Following a theft that damaged an air conditioning unit, a Dubuque church is making alternate plans for services and events. Reverend Kevin Goodrich said copper piping was stolen from the air conditioning unit at St. John's Episcopal Church, 1410 Main Street. Events in the main church will have to take place in alternate locations until the air conditioning is fixed. It renders the air conditioning unit inoperable in our historic 19th century church, Goodrich said. It's always tough for the church community and community when people do damage to a sacred place. Dubuque Police Lieutenant Ted McClellan said copper thefts are occasionally reported, mostly from commercial air conditioners. We would encourage people with special commercial air conditioners, bigger units like that, that people put a motion light or camera out there, he said. It could be a preventative measure. McClellan said the church theft is still under investigation and officers are looking through surveillance camera footage near the church during the 6-day span from when the theft might have occurred. He said the copper stolen was worth an estimated $1,000. Goodrich said church staff noticed the air conditioner had stopped working during services last Sunday. Church staff have estimated that the damage to the unit will cost more than $25,000 to repair, including the cost for extra security near the unit. Goodrich noted that the church officials are currently seeing what insurance will cover in costs, but they would accept donations to cover the remaining repairs. St. John's will also be making alternate plans for services and events until the air conditioning unit is fixed. Goodrich said officials are working out a plan to maintain the church's 1881 organ, which is temperature sensitive. Goodrich said he will try holding Sunday services in the church basement this Sunday, but if that is still at too uncomfortable a temperature, services will move to the parish house and community center at 1458 Locust Street. He added that there were no weddings scheduled at the church this summer, but anyone who wishes to have funeral services at St. John's may use the smaller chapel at the parish house. Goodrich said it might be 3 months until services can once again be held in the main church. Due to ongoing shipping delays, needed parts for an air conditioner repair might take weeks to come in. It's regrettable, he said. There are people that are sad and concerned, yet we are not our buildings, and our mission will continue. Now we have our news in brief. A man accused of shooting and killing another man in Dubuque has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. Kewanee D. Evans, 30, of Freeport, Illinois, entered a plea of not guilty in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to charges of first-degree murder, first-degree robbery, and possession of a firearm by a felon. The charges stem from a shooting that occurred at about 7 p.m. June 4th in the 1900 block of Central Avenue. Police reported that they found Taiwan M. Jackson Jr., 20, of Dubuque, on the ground with multiple gunshot wounds. He was pronounced dead at a Dubuque hospital. John E. Holston told officers he was having a birthday barbecue at his residence, court documents state. Those invited included Holston's niece and her husband, who also brought along his nephew, Evans. Holston said he saw Evans come up behind Jackson and shoot him with a handgun in the back of the head and then again in the face, documents state. Police obtained surveillance video which shows Evans shooting Jackson from behind him in the back of the head. Video also shows Evans shooting Jackson Jr. two more times while on the ground. The surveillance video also shows Evans rolling Jackson over and taking an item out of his pocket, which Holston reported was a handgun. Evans was arrested about 12 hours after the shooting in the 2100 block of Holiday Drive. Court records show that Evans has another court appearance scheduled for June 27th. Man involved in two Bellevue burglaries. A Grant County, Wisconsin man was arrested Thursday after authorities said they believe he was involved in a pair of burglaries in Bellevue earlier this week. Jeffrey D. Campbell of Harrison Township was arrested at his residence on charges of possession of stolen property and a felon in possession of a firearm. Well, now we end with our weekend buzz. All the noteworthy things to do this weekend in the tri-state areas. And we have the Great Galena Balloon Race 2022, Friday through Sunday, 400 Eagle Ridge Drive in Galena, 5 to 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 5 a.m. Sunday. This annual fundraiser for JDRF and Camp Herco Hollow will feature live music, hot air balloon races and rides, and the Hot Air Balloon Night Glow After Dark. This year's event will feature the Great Galena Art Show on Saturday, as well as a classic car show. Cost $5 admission, cash-only event. 12th Annual Juneteenth Celebration, Saturday, Comiskey Park, 255 East 24th. Noon to 3 p.m., Dubuque's Multicultural Family Center will commemorate the ending of slavery in the United States with its annual celebration. The event will include music, children's activities, free food, a talent show, dance and choir performances, resource booths, and vendors from Black-owned businesses. Admission is free. Call 563-582-3681 for more information. And we have the Relay for Life in Lafayette County. That's going to be from 5 to 9 p.m. on Saturday. And we have the Clausen Family Music Show at the Onward Fine Arts Center, 7 o'clock and on Saturday. And we have Sunday in the Garden at the Dubuque Arboretum and Botanical Gardens from 2 to 3:30. Free ice cream will be served at McKay Plaza on Sunday. This has been IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And it's Ken reading from the Friday, June 17th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm hoping you have a wonderful, though hot, weekend ahead. Stay hydrated, take care, and you'll hear from me again in another week. So long.